This morning, we're going to have an informal session, and I'd like to acquaint you with some of my friends, Rocks and Minerals, so that they become your friends as well. And I think before we go outside, and I do want to make this a kind of a laboratory session, where we'll have a chance to go out and look at some of these things on our own. We'll just go out by the schoolhouse, and it won't take us more than 2 or 3 minutes to get out there. But before we do this, let's have a little skull session in here and get acquainted with some of these things from the point of view of what we might illustrate on the blackboard and talk about here. Then go outside and take a look at some of the common materials. And I'd like to start out with showing you a sample of the Rock of Ages, granite. All of you know granite. Whenever you go to buy a monument or anything, you go to the sign where it says that they have the best rock of ages, you know, the rock that will last the longest. And then you have the inscriptions and whatever you want to put on it. Or if you build a building, so on, the idea is that these rocks are permanent. They last and last and last. They're the rocks that are the things that you can rely on staying intact. Now, let me show you what happens to a good granite when it's exposed to the weather and the normal things at normal temperature, oxygen in the air, water which comes from the rain, and the sunshine which provides the energy, and then just let nature take its course. The granite decomposes, and I have a piece here, a piece of granite that I collected at Cloudy Pass. Now, a good piece of fresh granite looks like this. Nice, clean, shiny, all the minerals are shiny. And you take this piece and you can break it all apart. I can virtually break this apart with my fingers. It's so rotten. We say it's rotten because the minerals are beginning to change. They're beginning to break down. So, let's see what happens to the Rock of Ages when it's exposed to the weather. Let's just look at some of the chemicals, just briefly, enough to get a little feel for this. And then you can look at this. I'll pass these two around, and you can be looking at them, comparing the two. You notice one looks like it has a lot of clay material on it. The other one looks very fresh. They're both granites. One has been exposed to the weather. The other one hasn't. Now, let's just start out now with this rock granite. Now, a rock of this kind, which is an igneous rock, a rock formed from molten magma, it was liquid, and then it became a solid. So you see, the Earth's materials, we really have three important categories. One is the gas, which is the atmosphere, basically. The other would be liquids, and the most prominent liquid we know on the Earth's surface, of course, is water. And we won't worry about this this morning in any detail. Then we have the solids, which are the rocks. And the rocks, when they're formed from liquids, where the liquids are under high heat, where the material was liquefied, crystallize and form crystalline rocks, and granite is the most common one that all of you would know. So we'll take granite now and look at what the common mineral families are that make up granite, just to get a feel for this. Feldspar. This may be a new term to you. It's the most common mineral that we have in the Earth's crust. And rocks, all rock, practically all igneous rocks, have feldspars in them. So we're going to find out a little bit more about this big family. Now, another very common group of rocks, feldspars, and then we have micas, various kinds of micas. Good. And then we have another big family of rocks, or minerals rather, the amphiboles, and the last would be quartz. Now, these are the materials that make up a granite in varying proportions. They aren't always the same, but you have to have some of these
some of each of these in order to make up a good ground. Now, you're all familiar with the fact that minerals now, which are solids, are also made up of other things. They're made up of chemicals, and the chemical elements that are in the minerals, if we just know a few of these, we know the basic things that go into the materials of the Earth's crust. Let's just list over here the common elements that are present in the Earth's crust. When you walk on the solid part of the Earth, what would be the most common element that's in all of these rocks? Anybody have an idea?
Oxygen.
Oxygen. Okay. So we'll put down oxygen. Now, what's the next one? Right. Now, oxygen and silicon are the two most abundant. As a matter of fact, we just give percentages here roughly, about 47% plus or minus. And silicon about 27%. Now, you see, of all of the Earth's crust, if you just know two elements, you know three-fourths of all the material in the rocks, all the rocks in the Earth's crust. Taking the first 10 miles down from here on down. Now, what's the next most common element?
Iron?
No, it isn't. Iron?
Aluminum?
Aluminum. 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 Now, this is only about 8%. Now, from here on, we drop off pretty fast. But there are another five that we ought to include. Another five that we ought to list here.
Nitrogen?
No.
Iron?
Iron is what?
Calcium?
Iron? Calcium?
Sulfur?
No.
Sodium?
Iron, calcium, sodium? Magnesium, how many are we at? 3, 6, 7. We're missing one. What's that? Potassium. Potassium. So potassium, magnesium, sodium, calcium, iron. Aluminum, silicon, and oxygen. Well, that's enough of this. Now we have some tools to work with. So let's look at what's in the minerals. And here, for example, let's take the first one, feldspar. This is what a crystal of feldspar looks like. And I'll just pass it on around and look at it. Now, let's look at what's in the feldspar in terms of elements. We'll just list them. The most important element is oxygen. And the next most abundant, silica. The next most abundant, aluminum. And then minor constituents of potassium, sodium, and calcium. All right, well, we're going to go through this pretty fast so that I don't hold you up here on something that you aren't going to remember. But you'll remember the basic part of this. In the micas, we have oxygen, silicon, aluminum, and potassium. In the amphiboles, we have oxygen, silicon, and now we begin to add other elements which are important. Iron, magnesium, and calcium, and maybe a little aluminum. Now, in the quartz, what do we have in the quartz?
Oxygen
and silicon, right. And that's all. Now, you can see that obviously we have different chemicals involved here. Some of these chemicals are more vulnerable to water and the atmosphere than others. Some of them are quite soluble, others aren't. So now, in this feldspar crystal that's making the rounds here, the thing that's really vulnerable in the feldspar crystal that the water is going to get at would be which of these elements? Here's one. I'll just put some circles around these that would dissolve rather easily.
Calcium?
Calcium also would.
Potassium.
Potassium also would. Now, the rest are very inert chemically, and they are not easily attacked. So, let's just take a look at these other minerals now and see what is vulnerable again. Here we have some potassium again. Now, if we have a black mica, as we sometimes have in the granites, we also have a little iron. So, if we put a little iron in here, this also would be vulnerable. Now, the rest, you see, the insoluble material is very much the same now. Now, let's look here. We have oxygen, silicon. What happens to iron when it's exposed to the weather? Rust. Just plain rust, just like our tailings over here. We're nice and black, now they're all brown because they've rusted. So the iron is easily attacked. The magnesium goes into solution. The calcium goes into solution. Now, here we have aluminum and silicon and oxygen left. Now, down here we have quartz, which is just oxygen and silicon. And neither one of these materials are easily broken down, so this material stays intact. Now, what I want you to see is what we get as an end product of this. Now, if you had oxygen and silicon and aluminum and added to that water. Now, how would you say this in words? This would be a hydrous aluminum silicate. Water, you see, if we just add plus H2O. Now, if we add that to what's left over, we see the water is what broke this down, so it's very likely that water would be added to this. Now, what is hydrous aluminum silicate?
Clay.
Anybody know?
Clay.
Clay. Just plain mud. That's what's on that piece of granite that you're handling. You see, the feldspars, which would make up the big bulk of the minerals in the piece of granite that's going around, the weathered piece, is breaking down, and the crystals of feldspar are actually forming clay. And this weakens the rock, and it begins to all fall apart. Now, if we simply collect this clay over here, let's just keep track of that now. Let's look at what we get from the micas when they are in the presence of normal atmosphere and water. The iron rusts and the potassium dissolves, and you have aluminum, silica, and oxygen. You add water to it, what do you got? More clay. So we get another increment of clay from the granite when it breaks down. Now, look at the amphiboles. The iron goes out, the magnesium goes out, the calcium goes out. And what do we have? We have a little aluminum, a little silicon, and oxygen. More clay. See? Is it any wonder we have so much mud on the surface of the earth? It comes from these minerals, you see. We started with this kind of rock at the surface of the earth to begin with. And we wind up with a lot of clay, which we call mud, dirt. It's the basis of our soil. It's the basis of all the plant and animal life, you see, finally, provides the soil which we're so dependent on. Now, what's this going to be? Now look at that little piece of granite that you have over there. Now, inside here are little crystals of quartz. Now, when all of this white material breaks down and forms clay, what's going to happen to the little crystals of quartz?
Nothing.
Nothing's going to happen. They're just going to be there. Well, now when the clay all washes away, and leaves the little quartz crystals concentrated behind, what are we going to call it? Sand. Sand. Just plain sand. And here it is. Here's a whole little ball full of sand grain. Where did it come from? Just simply released from the granite. When the white changed to clay, the little sand crystals, they're crystals of quartz. And most sand is quartz sand. You see, and most of it comes from the breaking down of a piece of granite such as this. So, here now, you don't add water to this or anything because water doesn't react with it, doesn't associate with it in any way. So this simply becomes sand, which has the composition of quartz. And quartz is very hard, and let me show you a quartz crystal. This is one of the crystals of quartz that one of the little boys found at the mine level the other day. And they brought it down here, and we're going to donate it to our museum. So we're grateful to them. This was a couple of the small fry. They had really good eyes, you know. They pick up things like that. This has beautiful crystal faces on it and everything. This is an example of what a quartz crystal would look like if it could form all of its faces and so on. So that's just one example now of what happens to an igneous rock when it's exposed to the weather. Now, why do these rocks break down so easily? For the simple reason that they're way out of phase with their environment. Where did a granite form? Forms way down deep in the Earth's crust, under high heat and high temperature, with a lot of energy, you see, down here in the form of heat and so on. And the crystals form under that condition. Now, a granite will be the rock of ages, so long as you leave it down in that kind of an environment. It'll never change. It'll never change. But when you bring it to a new environment, you expose it in the core of a mountain range. Then, you see, the energy levels have completely changed. And now, instead of it being under high pressure, it's under very low pressure. Instead of being under high heat, it's under very normal, moderate temperature. Now, what does this tend to do to the minerals? It tends to make them unstable, so that chemically they want to react, you see. They want to change their energy levels to get in phase with the new energy level. So now a new mineral forms, and this is what produces change. It's simply changing the energy level so that we have, instead of a good feldspar crystal now, we have good clay, and clay is crystalline material also, but it has a very loose packing of the atoms and of the materials that form the clay, so that it's stable now in this environment. You know, dirt and mud, this is very stable in our environment, and it doesn't change because it's in balance, and it stays that way until something happens to it. So this is the situation that you find. Now, we could go through some other rocks to see what would happen to them. If you took a gabbro or something that had a lot of other materials in it, much more iron, magnesium, and calcium and so on, then we would get a lot more of these materials released. Well, now let's follow what happens to this material that dissolves. See what happens to that. For example, here, the calcium now, which is in the water, this is the stuff, you see, when you put it on the stove and leave the tea kettle back until it finally goes dry, and you look inside the tea kettle, and you've got a coating on the inside. Now, what's the common material that we get from calcium?
Lime.
Lime. And then, the next thing, if it precipitated out, or if animals used it in their shells. And here I have a whole bunch of fossils. Now, where do the fossils get their material to make their shells? Here's a nice shell, a couple of shells of fossils. What is this material? It's lime. Lime. It got it from the granite and from other rocks that broke down to provide this material to the water. Now, the animal takes it out of the water, puts it in his shell, makes a nice shell for it, and then when the animal dies, the shell settles to the bottom of the sea, and the shell fragments accumulate to form limestone. Or the lime simply precipitates out, and it forms a limestone. So now you see we have the ingredient for limestone. What's another common rock that many of you know from back in the Middle West that's very much like a limestone?
Shale.
No? No? Very much like a limestone. It has calcium in it, but it also has magnesium. Calcium magnesium carbonate would be dolomite. And you have a lot of quarries back home that are dolomite quarries and limestone quarries and sometimes mixtures of the both. Now, depending on how much magnesium. All you have to do is add magnesium to this. Now, we have sand, which makes then sandstone. So, we'll just simply make this sandstone. And clay stone is called what? Shale. So, we'll just change that to shale. So, we have shale, sandstone, limestone, dolomite. And if the sodium combined with chlorine,
salt.
Here we have salt. And the potash, you see, that many of you came across the Canadian highway, and Saskatchewan is famous for its potash deposits. And there's a lot of potash, so this is where that comes from. You see, and it comes right out of these igneous rocks to start with, by this process. So here we have potash, you see, in these two places. Now then, we've accounted for all of the materials that we got out. Now, what's going to happen if we put this back into the earth under pressure and heat again? These materials now then would be unstable again because they'd be under high temperature and under high pressure, and they would recrystallize again. This is what we call the metamorphic rocks, the changed rocks. And the clay or shale now becomes what would be the metamorphic equivalent of this? Slate. Now the sandstone would change to quartzite. The limestone would change to marble. Now, these are the kinds of materials we have in this area. Now, if you had a mixture of sandstone and clay, here, very often we get another rock, so if we just mix these two, we put them together, we get a schist. And if we get a real coarse sandstone, here, this may become a gneiss. So if we get an impure conglomerate, you see, or a mixture of very coarse sand and so on, then we get a gneiss. Now, let me show you some of these materials that we have here. Here's a gneiss, for example. Well, you can see that it's banded, and the banding is related to this new crystallization process. If I show you a bigger piece, you can see here's another example. You can see that this has grain to it. And it tends to split to some degree, but it's coarsely banded. Now the reason that it's banded is that the new minerals now that form are going to grow in the direction of easiest growth. So if I put pressure on this from this way, the minerals are going to grow at the opposite direction from which the pressure comes. This is the way we grow, isn't it? In the direction of easiest growth. Tend to. Not against the pressure. See? We don't tend to grow against them. We tend to line up with the direction of least on pressure. So, rocks and minerals have a tendency to do the same thing. And this is the characteristic thing about the metamorphic rocks, is that they have this kind of foliation to them. And a schist is even more common. A schist splits very easily. This is not a real good example, but we'll see some out on the rock pile where you can pick up some schists that split very easily because they have the minerals that are all lined up in one direction, one plane. And then when the minerals tend to split, Why, it causes the rock to have a grain to it. And this is different from the granite which you're passing around, where the crystals go in any direction. You see, there's no preferred orientation. You can put all the pressure you want to on a liquid, you know, and the crystals will still grow in any direction. But when you apply pressure to solids, this makes quite a different thing. If they recrystallize from the solid state, then they're going to line up so that the minerals get all aligned. And this becomes the thing by which you can identify them. Now, we have three major kinds of rock then. The igneous rocks, which are from the molten condition, which is represented by granite. We have the sedimentary rocks, which are the products that break down from the igneous rocks. And these are particles, you see, that accumulate as sand and clay and limestone and so on. And then we have the other group of rocks, which are the metamorphic rocks, which are the changed rocks. And these can either be changed, recrystallized granite, or they can be changed sedimentary rocks. Now, in our area here, all of the rocks are crystalline. They all belong to either this group or this group. We're missing all of this group right here in the Holden area, for the simple reason that we're right in the midst of the core of the mountain range, of the Cascade Mountains. All of these rocks of this kind that we have had here in the past have now been converted over to this kind of material. Now, all are recrystallized, and they're all very hard. And for this reason, they're different from the rocks that you normally have back in the Midwest, unless you get up into Canada. Then you see you get this kind of rock again, and the granites and intrusions of various kinds. Yesterday we talked about basalt. Basalt is related to granite, except that it has more iron and more magnesium and so on. And other igneous rocks vary in their composition, of course. So we have a whole host of names, but granite is a good representative. And I think we'll not try to go any farther than that. Now, in this process, we get beautifully complicated rocks in this area. This is an example of one here where the material inside here is a mica schist. This white material is a granite, and you can see how pieces of this older rock were included in the soupy material of this granite when it came and was injected into this area. And it just included pieces, you see, of the older rock that was already there. And you can see it as you look at it. Here, for example, is a piece that I think even from where you sit, you can see that it's broken along a crack. This crack comes right down through here. Either side that you look at, you can see that it had a break in. Now, you can also see, if you look at it closely, that there is a mineral matter that has filled that crack. Now, it's this kind of cracking and the fact that the mineral matter then was allowed to come into the crack that produced the condition which made the mine over here possible. And here, for example, is a piece of the ore that comes out of the mine area over here. You can see all of the copper minerals that are in here. The yellow sparkle looks like fool's gold. But it's the same kind of thing that allowed for this material to come in. This is just a big chunk out of the ore body that produced the Holden mine across the creek. And I'll leave these here so that you can take a look at them. Here's an example of what happens to a quartz vein. Quartz vein that has a little iron mineral in it, you see. And along a little fracture here, and the iron rusts. And so you get a nice rusty color. This is always a giveaway for mineral matter. Usually we get some iron associated with the various kinds of ore. And the iron always oxidizes and rusts. And so whenever we see this kind of color, we're always on the alert to look for other things as well. And you can see that this material is rusty. You can look at it. It looks rusty. And when you want to look for a piece of ore, look for the rustiest thing, the heaviest thing you can find, and break it open very frequently. It'll have this, these other minerals in it. Well, now, rather than stay in here and worry about some of the details of this, we have now established that there are three kinds of rock. One kind we won't find, the sedimentary rocks, but we will find examples of the metamorphic rocks and the igneous rocks, and I think we'll just go on out to the rock pile and each of us pick up a rock that you want to identify or you know the name of, and we'll just make a few little piles out there and see what we can find in the way of things that you can identify and get acquainted with here so that you would understand and know at least a few of the common rocks that you find right here in the Holden area. Now, and then if you want to try this further, well, you can go up on the rock pile over in the mine here, and we have lots of rocks to identify. And we have a good number of them named up in the museum up at the upper mine level. If you want to make a rock collection, we certainly could spare a few. So you can have all you can carry out, I'm sure. And one of the difficulties in this area that we're really missed is the fact that we don't have any fossils. Now, for that reason, I brought along a few, and you can have a chance to look at them here any time that you wish. And I'll leave them out during the day here so that you might have a chance to just look at them and see. Now, one of the things that makes it possible for fossils to be preserved is the fact that we get so much of this kind of material, silica, free silica, released to the groundwater, and so that there can be a replacement of the bone matter by silica, oftentimes, or by calcium carbonate, or even by iron. And so the fossils then represent something that has to do with these materials that are released, and then the organic material becomes replaced by this, molecule for molecule. So that, well, I could show you here a piece of, here, for example, is a piece of a dinosaur bone. Now, there isn't any bone here at all. This is all mineral matter. It's all quartz, you know. But it has been replaced so completely, even to the cell structure of the bone, that you could take a section of this and it would be just as complete as if you had the original bone. There isn't any change in the detail of it, although there isn't any bone. But this is a fossil, completely replaced. Here, for example, is a nice little fern leaf, frond, a fern. And the reason that it's a preserve is nature provided a way to encase it with iron carbonate in this case. And the reason it's there is because the carbon served as a reducing agent to cause the iron carbonate to deposit around it. And you see that it always has just exactly the right shape and the right size of the material to just implode. Simple reason is that the carbon, once it gets out, has no further effect on the deposition of the iron, so it just encases it with this nice little coating, and it's preserved. This is just 250 million years old.
Can you tell what kind of rock the outside of it?
Well, you can when you get into this area, because the shapes give away what's on the inside. And if you had a twig on the inside, this would be perfectly round. But since the firm frond is flat, why, it's just the right shape to the color, you see, and oftentimes you can tell before you ever break it, have a pretty good idea of what's going to be inside. Yes, this could very well be. You see, any organic material, the carbon in the organic material causes other minerals to deposit around it when it gets in the presence of a groundwater situation where this can happen. Well, here's, for example, here's some wood. This happens to be a chunk of elm. Now, it's found right out here in the Columbia Plateau. There isn't any wood here at all. This is all silica, but here is a piece now where the replacement is so complete that it's just as good as if you took a slice out of an elm tree right here and made a section of it. So, you may look at these all you wish then, but why don't we go outside now and see if we can identify some rocks.